This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
Sweep! It's a sweeping edition of Rico Bronya as the New York Mets take the brooms out on those Redbirds from St. Louis, defeating the Cardinals 7-4 in Game 4, beating them 3-0 on Saturday afternoon at Citi Field. The pitching continues to be outstanding, and we are looking at a baseball team that is 15-7 and 2 games up on the Philadelphia Phillies as they get set to face the Phillies in a 3-game series. We got a lot to do on the Rico. We'll name our Rico star of the series. Had a lot of really good candidates. We'll break down Game 4. We'll break down Game 3. We'll look ahead to the Philly series. We got updates on Mark Vientos, Jeff McNeil, Francisco Alvarez. So a lot to do. But I'll give you about 5 minutes on WrestleMania. So if you're not a wrestling fan, that's totally fine. You could skip the first 5 minutes. You get right to the baseball. We'll put a clock on right now, 5 minutes on wrestling, and then back to the important stuff, like being 15-7, 22 games into a baseball season. Both my kids fell asleep, and my kids love wrestling, so I'd be very curious to get their feel for WrestleMania when they're able to wake up and watch the main event. But as this old man, as in me, who has seen all of the WrestleManias, this one absolutely sucked. I got to tell you, I mean, there were good moments. They were good matches, but WrestleManias are defined, in my opinion, by the main event. They're defined by the lasting image or the lasting thought of the match that ends the show. So while there may be some good matches in the middle, and there were, I thought the women's triple threat match was very good. I even thought last night's main event was very good until that absurd ending. This main event between John Cena and Cody Rhodes, I mean, it was okay, but you're telling me you're going to end it with Travis Scott? I mean, do we give a rat's ass about Travis Scott? He was the guy who was awkwardly a part of the Cena heel turn that I figured would be the answer to the trivia question in 20 years. Who was the very popular musician who 20 years ago was standing in the ring with legends like Rock, Cena, and Cody when Cena finally turned heel? And then, because The Rock is too busy filming a million movies, and God bless him, you know, he doesn't have to be a professional wrestler anymore, The Rock has to be a part of a heel turn, never get mentioned for another month and a half, and then send, I hate to call Travis Scott his lackey, but in terms of wrestling, his lackey out there, who looks like me in terms of being intimidating. I mean, Travis Scott is skinny. He doesn't have any molly. He's intimidating. He comes into the ring with a replica hardcore title. I mean, come, it was laughably horrible. Like, why are you getting Travis Scott involved in the main event of WrestleMania? I'm not even mad. I'm laughing about it. And then even the ending of Cody's got to choose. Am I a good guy? Am I a bad guy? Do I hit John Cena with the belt? It was awful. And I know last year was so good, like the main event last year not only featured the ending that you needed, which was Cody Rhodes finishing his story, but the overbookedness of it was great. You know, everything made sense. Cena returns to take out Solo Sikoa. Seth Rollins comes out. The Rock comes out. Even The Undertaker, which wasn't perfect. You know, you could see how it made sense. So I know it's coming off the heels of like one of the great WrestleManias of all time, but this sucked. This was awful. And I blame The Rock. I really do. Look, we love you, Rock. But if you can't be involved in WrestleMania, which is fine, it's your prerogative. You are not a part of WrestleManias for a goddamn decade. You know what I mean? That's fine. why are you a part of all these stories then? You know, from setting the Rock versus Cody story that really never happened to maybe Rock versus Roman story that definitely never happened to wait a second. No, wait, I will be on TV. I want to buy your soul, Cody. I want to own your soul to this really good moment. And then you're gone again and nobody even talks about you. I blame the Rock. So anyhow, what can I tell you? I thought it sucked. And where do they go from here? I don't know. I mean, maybe it'll be interesting, I guess. Cena will have some new opponents to defend this title, but he looked lame. He looked weak. It was cool seeing the crowd kind of side with John Cena, because after all these years, I think people were like, yeah, you finally turned bad. We like you now. But I thought the ending sucked. And when I say that it sucked, again, were there good moments in the middle? Absolutely. The Intercontinental title match was very good. Becky Lynch's return was very good. So it isn't fair to say the show sucked, because the show was okay, but the ending to the show was horrible. And even WrestleMania Saturday, the main event was great. I don't love Paul Heyman signing with Seth Rollins. It doesn't make any sense. I thought Triple H was this master storyteller. Not good. Now let's get to the stuff that was good. And that was the Mets. So hopefully you enjoyed that little very quick WrestleMania recap. But now let's get to the Mets stuff. I think what is so cool right now as a Met fan, besides the record, which is the most important thing, 15-7, but you're starting to see the strength of this team wake up. Like, their pitching has been awesome, and there's no denying it. And you want to give the pitching lab a lot of credit for a lot of what we've seen. Sure, it is still only 22 games, so I think there's going to be a healthy skepticism, obviously, that the pitching staff isn't going to carry them the rest of the year. But you're starting to see Juan Soto wake up, which we saw really begin on Friday after the standing ovation of all things. This was an incredible series for Francisco Lindor. Lindor looked like MVP Lindor. Pete continued to be Pete for the most part. I know he sort of cooled off at the end, taking a 1-for-5 in game 4. But for the most part, you know, hit a home run in game 3, had that crazy triple on Friday night. So you got the monsters all starting to hit. And that's, to me, one of the special things about this team. You've got a 1-2-3 in the batting order that features a guy that was an MVP candidate last year, one of the great hitters of our generation in Juan Soto, and a slugger in Pete Alonso, who is like a waking up giant. So it was great to see Soto hit this weekend, to see Lindor look like his MVP self. But the pitching continues to be phenomenal. Let's start with the finale of this series as the Mets look for the sweep. On Sunday afternoon, you know, Clay Holmes got off to an awful start. He walks Lars Nootbaar on 4 pitches. There's an audible groan at Citi Field. And to Clay Holmes' credit, he gets Gacy out. He gets Donovan out. He works through trouble after he gives up the base hit to Wilson Contreras by getting Burleson to strike out. And for the most part, Clay Holmes threw another really impressive performance. He kept his pitch count low enough to where even at 74 pitches through 5, there was an avenue for him to come out, get those 3 outs in the 6th inning like he did. And he needed it, because this was a bullpen that was going to be shorthanded. But Clay Holmes was really, really good, especially after the tough start. Ends up retiring 8 in a row in the middle of it, works through trouble in the 4th inning, works through trouble in the 5th inning, helped out by some really good defense by Francisco Lindor. And also really worked through trouble in the 6th inning. Now, he was bailed out by his defense, because he gives up the leadoff double to Donovan. He throws the wild pitch that basically turns into a run on a ground out. And then Jordan Walker, it's a home run. Except Brandon Nimmo is Spider-Man leaping over the fence to make that incredible catch. I have to tell you not a private moment, but how I dealt with the Nimmo catch. So on Sunday, and it's an adventure when I take my youngest son to games, because he's only 4 years old. And when you take a 4-year-old to a game, it's not the way it is with my oldest son, where we sit there, we watch the game, and that's it. He's 4. So there's going to be a lot of activities, such as kiddie field, such as getting ice cream, such as him looking at me. And I appreciated this, because one of the issues I have sometimes with my sons is they don't tell me when they got to go to the bathroom. You got to tell me. Got to go to the bathroom. I'm going to take you. So he looks at me in the top of the 6th inning and says, I got to go. And I'm like, oh, you got to go? I said, you know what? How about we wait till this half inning is over? And then he looks at me. He's like, I got to go bad. I was like, all right, listen, no questions asked. We don't want an accident at Citi Field. So we go into the men's room where there's a line, by the way. I haven't seen a line at Citi Field, the men's room, forever. Now, maybe that's because I time out my bathroom visits very well. Like, as an inning ends, I fly out and I get to the restroom. And this was mid-inning, sixth inning. I don't know. So we're waiting on the line. We get in there. Again, four-year-old. So there's a little bit of work going on here. Got to go into the where you close the door, the stall. I don't want him touching anything because it's a men's room and it's disgusting. So I lift him up, make sure he can go. Great. We're all done. Wash our hands. Mama's going to be happy. As we're getting out of the bathroom, I hear the gasp from the crowd. Like, I don't know what it is. Obviously, I know the Cardinals are up, but I hear that loud, oh! And I quickly run to the seat, and everybody's freaking out. I was able to go back on my phone, showed it to young Spence, and saw that brilliant catch by Brandon Nimmo. So I saw it on my phone about 5 minutes after it happened, not as it happened. But that's the adventure of going to games with your kids. I'm sure most people understand that. That's part of the deal. But it was still special. It was still awesome. Brandon Nimmo leaping up, making that catch. I remember when he made the catch a couple of years ago with Jake on the mound against the LA Dodgers playing center field at the time. But that was a big play, and I think that's what made it so easy for Carlos Mendoza to know, all right, this is it for Clay. 91 pitches. And look, it's not even just about the pitch count. It's knowing when a guy is done. He gives up a double. He gives up what should have been a home run. Clearly, his day was over. But 6 innings, 4 hits, 1 run. He only walks 2 guys, including that first batter of the game that he walked on 4 pitches. This was another very encouraging performance by Clay Holmes. And so, Hoff, I don't know if you're ready to apologize because you were the person to declare 2 starts ago. Quite frankly, Clay Holmes is not a starting pitcher. I would certainly say 6 innings, 4 hits, 1 run, 6 strikeouts, 91 pitches is exactly what you want from a starting pitcher. So are you ready to apologize or do you remain very skeptical about what Clay Holmes is?
I'll take the L on this one right now. I will. I mean, he's proven me wrong. I was very much in line after watching the first few starts of him that if he got through 5 innings, that'd be great. But he now is getting consistently 6 innings, and that's it's good. Let's keep it going.
Keep it going, baby. And it's important to get 6 innings because you even saw this over the last couple of days. Like, they got a good performance out of Kodai Senga. We'll get more into that coming up in a little bit. He didn't get through the 6th inning, but he did pitch well into the 6th inning. And you knew you sort of had a shorthanded bullpen. You know, I'm not sure how much they wanted to use Edwin Diaz since he had pitched 2 out of the last 3 days. You also have 3 games coming up against Philadelphia. And I'm sure that even though it's early in the season, you're not looking at the standings. You want to go into that series relatively fresh. So you have a bullpen that while it doesn't have everybody down. I'm not sure if AJ Minter was ever going to be available in a game like this. I don't think he was. And certainly we saw it by Danny Young coming in to pitch the 7th inning. So getting 6 innings from your starters on a day like Sunday, and really in general, is very important. So you want to push them, but you don't want to push them too much. We grade our starters around here. That's a B-plus performance by Clay Holmes, especially the way it started. You know, it's a groan when you begin a game with 4 straight out of the strike zone. And immediately, I thought this was interesting. You don't see this often. Clay Holmes walks Lars Nupar in 4 pitches to start the game. Okay, it happens. Not great. That groan from the crowd on an Easter Sunday, not ideal. Hefner went out immediately, which you don't see often. So I'm not sure what Jeremy Hefner told Clay Holmes, but whatever it was, it worked. B-plus performance by Clay, 6 strong innings. The offense, it starts with a Lindor home run, which was a real tone setter. They had scoring opportunities. They did get the Juan Soto sacrifice fly after Lindor pounded the base hit in the 3rd inning that got Tyrone Taylor 1st to 3rd. They had a scoring opportunity in the 4th inning after the catcher's interference. Unfortunately, Taylor popped up. They had another scoring opportunity in the 5th, and Pete Alonso came through with a big RBI single. So you saw them chipping slowly against a tough customer in Sonny Gray, where they were getting hits, they were getting big hits. It wasn't your typical frustrating performance. But at 3-0, was it going to be enough? And Clay gives you the 6 good innings. They go to Danny Young to start the 7th, which, look, I don't think anybody's excited about Danny Young coming into a 3-1 game. You need 9 outs. You're not sure entirely who's available in the bullpen, but you know that you're asking Danny Young to get the first couple of outs. The first hit he gave up to Nolan Gorman was just bad luck. But then the thing you can't do with a 2-run lead is walk the 9 hitter ahead of Lars Nupar. But luckily, Danny Young stayed in lefty-lefty, got Nupar out. And here's Jose Buteau, who's been very, very streaky this season, giving up that first pitch 2-run double to tie the game up. If I'm not mistaken, Jose Buteau on that at-bat is the only pitch he threw, because Sagacy swung at the first pitch. It was a slider. I think it was the only slider Jose Buteau threw. And to give Buteau a little bit of credit, and I do, after he gives up that huge hit to kind of put the exclamation point on the Mets blowing a 3-0 lead in the 6th inning, now the 7th inning, he gets Brendan Donovan out, which is not easy. Very few teams and very few pitchers are getting Brendan Donovan out this early in the season. Guy's hitting about 380. So he gets him to hit that tapper in front of the plate that Hedin Sanger makes a good play on, and then comes out and pitches a 1-2-3 8th inning, in which I think he threw the slider away and said, I'm not going to use it. I'm going to go heavy changeup, heavy fastball, and he was able to get a couple of strikeouts and a ground out. So Buteau, who has not been great this year, in fact, after he gave up the double to Sagacy, I was even thinking to myself, he's not in the circle of trust. Most relievers this season, because the Met bullpen's been so electric, basically everybody's in the circle of trust. But I was almost excommunicating Jose Buteau after he gave up the double to Sagacy, along with Danny Young. I mean, those two guys are the ones you use when everyone else is tired. But Max Kranick's in the circle. Ryan Stanek's in the circle. A.J. Minter's in the circle, obviously. Edwin Diaz, Reed Garrett, Oscar Brazoban, despite the blown save the other night. They're all in that circle. But I was ready to excommunicate Buteau. But give him credit, man. A 1-2-3 eighth inning, and that's right after the Mets respond by getting a monstrous hit by your boy, Brandon Nimmo. Because that inning in the 7th inning was such an important inning. After you blow the lead, you're in the Cardinal bullpen, which is not very good. So I think you did a solid job against Sonny Gray, getting him out after 6 innings, making him throw 103 pitches. 6 innings, 3 runs. I know it's a quality start. That's good work against a tough customer like Sonny Gray. And you give yourself 9 outs potentially to attack a Cardinal bullpen that you've looked pretty good against. You get the infield hit by Lindor. By the way, I was surprised. Just a little first guess action on Mendy. Hedin Sanger got pinch hit 4 in the 8th inning, but he didn't get pinch hit 4 in the 7th inning. So he let Sanger begin the bottom of the 7th of a tie game and let him hit and didn't go to his bench. I wasn't sure if Vientos was available. We'll get into the Vientos injury coming up. But he lets Sanger bat. He strikes out. Then they get the infield hit by Francisco Lindor, basically the swinging bunt. Soto draws a walk. They didn't want to face him. I think that was one of those sequences where, actually, I shouldn't even say that, because Romero was in to face him. Like, once, whether he gets Soto out or not, he's being pulled for the righty to take on Alonso. So I can't even say he wasn't looking to face him. I think he was just being careful, because Juan Soto is such a dangerous hitter, and we certainly saw him wake up over the last few days. But Pete striking out with 2 on, 1 out against Maton was very disappointing. And it felt like this inning, this opportunity in the 7th, was going to go for naught, especially with the heart of the order coming up. And then who knows? You know, at that point, I wasn't exactly confident Buteau was going to get through the 8th inning after he gave up the 2-run hit to Sagacy. So I think the Brandon Nimmo at-bat was a very, very important at-bat. And an at-bat that was going to tilt this game one way or the other. Because when you blow a lead like that, which the Mets did, you want to be able to respond quickly. And he's behind in the count 1-2. I had no confidence. I'll be honest with you. I'll raise my hand. I did not believe Brandon Nimmo was coming through. He was 0-for-3 at this point. Had not made a lot of hard contact, despite the fact that, yes, a lot of his stats have shown you he has made good contact this year and has hit into some bad luck. And he pounds one up the middle for a 2-out RBI single. Behind in the count, too. So Brandon Nimmo, in a lot of ways, was the hero of Sunday's game. The leaping catch robbing a home run of Jordan Walker, the RBI single picking up Pete, who had come through two innings earlier with a two-out hit in the seventh inning, gives them the lead, and that's why Buteau's lockdown eighth was so damn impressive. You're still nursing a one-run lead. Mendy's asking Buteau to go back out there against 4, 5, and 6 of the order, and he made it look very, very easy. And then you have the eighth inning where they broke this whole thing open. Luis Angel Acuna, who has been such a fire plug. He has been a spark plug, not really a fire plug, a spark plug, and is demanding everyday at-bats. And we'll get more into that as this pod goes on. Rips that double. Or actually, no, this wasn't the rip double. I apologize. This was the chopper where off the bat, I'm thinking, there's no way the third baseman Gorman's going to throw him out. Or it may have been the shortstop. I think it was the third baseman Gorman. Because the reason I think that is I remember feeling if Arenado's out there, he can make any play because he is the modern-day Brooks Robinson. But the ball goes underneath the bare hand of Gorman, and Acuna takes off, and it turns into a slow-rolling double, which was an example of the electricity that Acuna brings. Beatty had the terrible at-bat where he struck out. I was just hoping for contact where he can move over to third. So Beatty had a little bit of a step-back offensive game despite his hot streak recently. He takes an 0-for-4, and then Tyrone Taylor bloops in the double. Torrens draws the walk, and after Lindor grounds out, we get, I'm going to tell you right now, my favorite Juan Soto moment of the weekend. And Juan Soto had a lot of great moments this weekend. We'll get into that later as well, especially the standing ovation that turned into basically him getting hot and Soto admitting after the game on Sunday, yeah, I heard it. It was shocking and it was awesome, and it fires guys up. And basically, you had a player tell you, this crap works. I don't know what we're supposed to do with it. Does that mean we're supposed to just give standing ovations to any player who's struggling? I don't know. But what I loved about the Soto moment in the eighth inning with a two-run lead is that, and I'm not trying to minimize any of the other Soto hits, but they were ground balls that found holes. And look, that's a part of his brilliance. He's a great hitter. So I don't like to give any hits back, but it was nice to see a vintage Juan Soto line drive, split the outfielders in left center field, go all the way back to the wall, score Taylor easily, score Lindor from first. That was the exclamation point on the Soto renaissance, if you will. Or really, it's not a renaissance. It's just a great player getting hot. It's a great player breaking out of a slump, which is why when he was struggling, it's okay to be frustrated because we're fans. We get frustrated over everything. But it was always nuts to ever be worried, because a great player is going to break out of it. And the more I think back on his slump, and even Pete Alonso's slump from last year, sometimes we try to make things convenient, like, oh, this guy's putting pressure on himself. Oh, he's feeling the heat of a contract year. Pete Alonso had a contract year last year. He has a contract year this year. Last year, he was underwhelming. So far through 22 games this year.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
He's awesome. So I love the Soto double. Also, and I blame myself for this, when we did our Friday night Rico, I received numerous emails questioning if Juan Soto was celebrating. So I read the email. I very quickly pot up the last few seconds of the game, and I can't find Juan Soto. Now, if you listen to the podcast, while I said I couldn't find him, I did not panic. I didn't say, all right, guys, this guy's miserable. He doesn't want to be here. But I described, yeah, I can't find him. Podcast ends. We get hundreds of emails. He's right here. He's right here. He's right here. I even saw this great TV version, the Cardinal version, in which you see him hopping up and down. So I went on Twitter. I put out the video and said, all right, we can put this stupid controversy to bed. And now I'm feeling guilty. Like, should I have I ever read the email questioning if Juan Soto was celebrating? But you know what's funny about this? There's other videos on social media of Met fans supposedly analyzing the video of Soto's celebration, saying he's not celebrating enough. So it went from, is he there? Which I admit, I didn't see him. But then after I saw 150 different views, he was clearly there. Then it turns into, is he celebrating enough? My fellow Met fans, calm the F down. Calm the F down. It's like we scored with this beautiful woman, and we still can't believe we scored with the beautiful woman. And so we're asking ourselves, is she only with us because of the money? Is she only with us as revenge against like some ex-boyfriend? Like, who cares? She's with us. He's with us. So I'm done getting involved in this. Is he celebrating too much? Is he smiling enough? And I apologize that I even read those emails and Hoff and I even got involved in this because it's stupid. He's fine. He's happy. He's a Met. Pipe down.
Well, I don't know if you listened to my show on Saturday morning, but that's actually how I basically led the show was don't worry about Juan Soto and if he's celebrating or not. And I gave two really good reasons of when you saw him, why I actually enjoyed how he celebrated, even though it wasn't that big of a deal, because A, the moment wasn't about him. It was about right. Lindor. So what do we care what Soto's doing? Like, enjoy Lindor. Let him have his moment. Soto's going to have plenty. Trust me. He's already having plenty of moments, and all we're doing is talking about how he's not hot yet. That's really what his moments are. Now, on second of all, does anybody remember Edwin Diaz from a few years ago celebrating, just jumping up and down? Why do I really want Juan Soto going and overreacting and being part of this nonsense celebration for a walk-off home run in April when we have a whole season to go through and get to the playoffs? I don't need a Kendrys Morales. I don't need any of that garbage. So you want to know what? I love to have Juan Soto celebrating. That's perfect. Keep it that way.
I also wonder, have we ever, not just Met fans, but baseball fans, have we ever overanalyzed the reactions of one specific player like this? It almost makes me want to go back to any Yankee walk-off from last year and analyze Soto's reactions to that. Because it's almost like it's a new analysis. Like, when have we ever done that? When have we ever broken down how excited guys have got? Did we do that when they first got Piazza? Like, you know what? He's not excited enough after that celebration. The whole thing is stupid. What I did think was fascinating, and I remember saying this on, I think the last Rico that we did, that the boos into cheers I thought was really, really interesting on Friday. So when we were there on Thursday, I didn't hear Juan Soto get booed. It was claimed that he got booed. Even Howie Rose said, I heard boos. I didn't hear it, which means, if anything, that if there were boos, they were not loud enough. They were not distinguishable enough. On Friday, I heard boos. In his first two at-bats, Juan Soto went ground out the first and ground out the first. And after he grounded out in the third inning, there were clear boos. Okay? No dispute. I heard it. I think everybody heard it. When he came up in the fifth inning in an RBI opportunity, he got a standing ovation. Like, people were standing up and they were cheering him. And what I thought was really, really cool about that, unlike what happened in Philadelphia with Trey Turner, even what happened with us last year with Lindor, is there clearly wasn't a conversation. It's not like we went on sports talk radio saying, you got to cheer Soto. Like, that didn't happen. There wasn't some private meeting. It was literally fans, and this is the way I'm interpreting this, and I don't know how anybody could disagree. I think it was fans who heard the boos saying, shut up, you don't represent us. We're going to go the other way by giving this guy a standing ovation. Because unlike Trey Turner, where it was a sports talk radio kind of insisted thing, and even Lindor, which was a social media sports talk radio thing, there was no buildup towards, hey, let's show support for Juan Soto. It naturally happened. And I find that 50 times more beautiful than something that's forced or something that's kind of contrived. And I really do believe that's the majority of Met fans angrily responding to this Soto boos by saying, all right, I'm not booing this guy. We're 20 games into a season. So what I'm going to do to respond is I'm going to give him a standing ovation. He heard it because he was asked about it on Sunday, and he said it made a big difference. And here are the numbers. Since Juan Soto got the standing ovation, 10 plate appearances, on base 7 times. So something clicked. He got the RBI single in that next at-bat, drew a walk at the remainder of the game in game number 2. Then on Saturday, RBI single in the 3rd, single in the 6th, and then goes 2-for-4. And then in Sunday's game, he struck out in the 1st inning, and then sac fly RBI, single in the 5th, walk in the 7th, 2-run double in the 8th. So I don't know if it's connected. It's one of those things where Juan said it helps. I'm sure it's nice. Like, no one wants to get booed. I think athletes and anyone would love to get a standing ovation. But I also think it's the other thing Juan talked about, which is he's a student of the game. And so even when you're a great player, even when, you know, you get paid $765 million, you get into bad habits. And you got to find a way to break out of it. And over Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, he broke out of it. I mean, it is what it is. On base 7 out of 10 times. That's not bad. Driving in 5 runs. That's not bad. And I thought the capper to it was beautiful, like I mentioned, because it was such a typical Soto play, a laser line drive up the alley in left center field. It was very good to see.
And here's the other thing, too, is the crowds, not only were they vocal in support of Juan Soto, they were physically there. And yes, that's a huge part of it. Because I'm a big MMA fan, a big UFC fan. And when COVID took place, they opened up this apex in Vegas. And basically, no one was allowed in there. So you heard every ounce of noise. You heard the coaches. You heard everything. You heard the announcers doing play-by-play. If you're in the cage, you heard all the outside noise. And no offense, but like when Citi Field is drawing 10,000 people, you hear a lot more of the single voices kind of cut through. When 40,000 people are there or close to it, you're going to hear just a lot of white noise and a lot of energy and not really sure what people are saying.
I'll tell you this. I was not there Saturday, but I got there Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. So I was there 3 out of 4 days, which is very – it's not usual for me. People may think it's usual for me. It's not. The place was not only filled. The place has a buzz. The place has an electricity. And I think it's a combination of factors. I think the success from last year, certainly a factor. And then the excitement of signing a guy like Juan Soto is a huge factor. So not only did the Mets get to announce massive attendance numbers, the game I wasn't at, the Saturday game, was a freaking sellout. They announced 42,000 people on a beautiful Saturday. But then on Friday, 39.6. On Thursday, 38.2. And even Easter Sunday, which I didn't think was going to be a big crowd, they announced 38.3. So some very big crowds for these 4 games against the St. Louis Cardinals. And not only big crowds, like you mentioned, crowds that were into it. Let's get to Saturday's game. Kodai Senga, this is very, very exciting because the Met pitching's been awesome, no question about it. But there's a skepticism that I have, and I think a lot of people have, on are they going to be able to maintain this? Even Clay Holmes. I'm impressed by Clay Holmes. I put in my Cy Young bet at the beginning of the year. This is still a converted reliever after all those years back into the rotation. We are watching him. We are enjoying him. He still has a lot to prove. Griffin Canning's off to a really good start. He's got a lot to prove. Tyler McGill's pitched really well. He's got a lot to prove. Can he remain in the rotation? David Peterson even still has a lot to prove. I mean, remember, it was a half a year last year. Kodai Senga is the guy we looked at and said he could be the ace of the team because we have no evidence that he can't be. I mean, think about it. Kodai Senga in his first year, and I know it bothers people that he can't pitch on 5 days. He needs that extra day. I know it bothers some people that so far earlier this season, his pitch count has been restrictive. But the reality is, watch the guy pitch. We saw him in 23. We're watching him now. You can see how he could be an ace. Now, I'd like to see more than 5 2/3 innings, but truthfully, Mendy managed it perfectly because after he hit Nolan Arenado in the sixth inning, and this was an inning in which three of the four guys he faced got on base as he's going third time around the batting order, so it wasn't a pitch count thing. We get lost in this too much. 89, is it too high at 89? Look, it's the most pitches he's thrown this year, but I wanted him out of the game not because of 89, but because of what I just said. Three of the four batters he faced in the sixth inning, walk, single, double play, hit batsman, three of the four got on base. So let me go to one of my top end relievers. But you continue to see, even in a start in which he wasn't his most dominant, how Kodai Senga can be the ace of this team. That ghost fork, when he gets ahead of hitters, is devastating. It is a devastating pitch when he can get ahead. The swing and misses he gets from it. He can be the ace of this team. He's got a lot more to prove in terms of pitch count, in terms of going deeper into games, in terms of remaining healthy, because it is tough to ignore that last year he wasn't healthy. And I'm not killing him for his postseason. The postseason was, I don't even know what to make of it. It's more about Mendy and the Mets and David Stearns thinking he was their best option to be in the rotation. But he pitched very well on Saturday. Worked his way through trouble. Second and third, nobody out in the second inning. Strikes out Nolan Gorman. And that was an example of when you need a strikeout, you get a strikeout. Strikeout numbers when looking at pitchers can sometimes be overrated. I know we love to see strikeouts and swing and misses, but to me, it's about when you get your strikeouts. There are certain sequences in a game where that strikeout is a hell of a lot more valuable than a fly ball to right field. When there is second and third and one out, you need a strikeout. And he threw, I think it was a couple of ghost forks in a row that Nolan Gorman had no shot at, struck him out in a big spot. Then he had clean third innings, clean fourth innings, same thing in the fifth inning. Gives up a leadoff double, and then we get good defense by Brett Beatty. And I tell you, man, Brett Beatty makes a throw to home to nail Thomas Ajayi. And this was the moment of mass confusion. Now, Hoff, let me know if you've got this clip ready from the Fox broadcast on Saturday, because my family gets home on Saturday, so I don't go to the game. I'm hanging out with them. I now watch the game on DVR, but I'm watching the game on DVR, and this is something I've learned how to do as a father, is I was this may be my most impressive work. I was watching the Met game with barely any sound, which is probably a good thing because of the Fox broadcast. I'm scoring it, but I'm playing WWE 2K25 with both my boys. So I'm playing the game with them. They're into it. I know what's going on. And this is how baseball's like secondhand in my brain. I'm watching the Met game, but not really paying the full attention that I normally do, but I'm still scoring it. When Beatty throws out Sajacy at the plate in the fifth inning, my antenna goes up because I'm like, wait a second, why is Brett Beatty in the game? Like, that's how I found out. So after we're done playing, I go back. I'm like, I got to see what the hell happened here. Like, what did I miss? And I guess that shows you that when you are watching a game, even if scoring it, but the video game is the priority, you're going to miss stuff. So I go back. This was much later on after the game was over. I go back because I got to figure out what the hell's going on. I see Vientos make the leaping catch. Is he hurt? I can't really tell. And then these guys on the Fox broadcast, Hoff, do you have this audio? Because this is freaking embarrassing.
Give me 1 minute. 1 minute, I'll get it for you.
I'm going to give you 1 minute because I'm going to set this up. So I go back to find out, all right, well, what happened? You know, Adam Wainwright, friend of the Rico, is probably going to tell us what happened. Whoever the broadcaster is, Benetti, he's going to tell us what happened, right? I'm expecting that because all of a sudden, Mark Vientos, who's waking up, right? Mark Vientos has arrived. Home runs in back-to-back games on Thursday, on Friday. He's making a leaping catch. It's like, hell, man. Vientos is back. And all of a sudden, he's out of the game for Brett Beatty. I don't know what's going on. When I go back and listen to Fox's broadcast explaining what happened to Mark Vientos, it was so embarrassing. It's why Fox should be banned from calling Met games for a month and a half. Because what you need to do, and I understand it's entertainment. I get it. I respect it. You're going to interview players. You're going to talk about food choices. You're going to do all these things because, hey, baseball's boring to half the people, right? May not be boring to me, may not be boring to our loyal Rico listeners, but they got to keep people entertained, right? But at the heart of a broadcast is you got to give us the information. At the heart of a broadcast, you got to tell us what the F is going on. You can't have us guessing. You can't have us confused. And if people at Fox or people at ESPN or people at Apple TV Plus, if they wonder why Met fans get so angry at you for your broadcast, it's because our broadcasters tell us what the hell is going on. Take a listen. This is from the Fox broadcast on how they tell us Mark Vientos is out of the game.
Not great news for the Mets right now. Mark Vientos is out of the game as Beatty is in. That's a pretty expensive chicken tender and fry for Adam Wainwright's dollar.
I missed it. What was it?
$16.39. You're not spending that. In the air, right field, down the line. That is a fair baseball into the right field corner. And two bases again for Sejacy. It's his second double.
Yeah, New York is great food, but not the cheapest. I had a $95 omelet for breakfast this morning.
Are you effing kidding me? Are you guys serious? You tell us not great news for Met fans. Vientos is out without even missing a beat. You know, those chicken fingers are expensive. And then when Sejacy hits this double, Adam Wainwright doesn't miss a beat. He's got to tell us about the omelet he bought in the morning. I mean, are you guys joking? Like, is that out of an SNL skit? Like, I know I can't do this. I know we can't do this. Fox should be banned from calling a Met game for a month after that kind of garbage. And then we sit there and we have no idea what happened to Vientos because you're too busy telling us about how chicken fingers are expensive and Adam Wainwright's overpriced omelet.
You want to know something that's crazy? This is actually the opposite of the Nick Castellanos trend. Like, usually something happens, it's breaking or bad, and we're like in like, oh, we're lost for words. And next thing you know, Nick Castellanos is hitting a grand slam home run, rounding the bases, and let's get back to the story. This is Mark Vientos injured into, let's just BS for 10 minutes. What, I mean, come on. Like, I got to be honest with you. That was not, I saw this clip a couple, like, floating around a bunch of different places. They should be disappointed because I understand that baseball at times gives you this, like, opportunity to, like, be a little bit more personable and sociable and try to have a little charisma and fun. But not then and there when you say, hey, Vientos is out. With what? With the flu? He got the shits? Like, what's going on?
That's the problem. Like, I'm not against them talking about chicken fingers. I'm against you doing it as you told us news that's causing 80% of Met fans to hyperventilate. But you should have seen my face finding out about this because, again, I'm playing a video game with my kids. I'm scoring the game. I don't realize Vientos is out until Beatty makes the play at the plate on Sejacy two batters later. And that's when I'm like, what the fuck? I mean, that's all. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And when I go back, because after this game is over, part of the problem when you're on DVR too is that I'm not going to Twitter. I'm not going to my text messages because I don't want the rest of the game to be spoiled. So I just get through it. I watch the game. And then after, especially when the kids passed out, I'm like, ah, let me go back and see what's going on. I go back. I see this. And I'm like, what the hell? They literally went from he's hurt to chicken fingers are expensive. Now, I want to throw this email in there. And damn it, I apologize. I forgot to write down the guy's name. Sometimes I copy and paste emails, but it's on the subject of Fox. The guy writes, I don't like the interviews done by the announcers on Fox. Both interviews happened while Kodai Senga was pitching. I couldn't focus on watching him. You're right. That's another problem. Like, I get the interviews. I get that, you know, there's a lot going on, but sometimes it's a distraction to actually what's happening in the game. Now, as far as the rest of the game was concerned, we mentioned Senga. I thought after he hits Arenado, it was a perfect time to get him out. He pitched well. He only gave up five base runners in 5 2/3 innings, but I thought what was going on in that sixth inning certainly led to making that change. And Reed Garrett, remember Reed Garrett last year was so up and down. He's been mostly good this season. I don't really give him a lot of slack for that loss in Minnesota. Comes in, runner on second, nobody out, gives up a leadoff hit. Like, crap happens. I'm not going to kill him for that. Gets a huge ground out of Burleson to end the sixth inning, pitches a 1-2-3 seventh inning. So Reed Garrett continues to be great, has not allowed an earned run yet this year. AJ Minter also. I didn't like him walking the bases loaded. I don't think anybody else did. But to ultimately make the big pitch when he needed to, and also get to see great defense by Francisco Lindor, because the Burleson hit with the bases loaded was not the easiest play that Francisco made. But you are judged by giving up runs or not. And so even though Minter walked three guys, he didn't give up any runs. And then Edwin Diaz gave you a rare shellac save. Comes in, throws strikes, gets the leadoff hitter out, which he had been struggling to do over the last couple of weeks. And they make the offense hold up. Alonso with an RBI double. Soto had the RBI hit with two outs in the third inning. Pete hit the insurance home run. Other than that, the offense did nothing. So if we didn't pitch well, we'd be more frustrated with the 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position. But they made three hold up and pull off that victory on Saturday.
So first of all, a couple things. The email was by G. So G. let's give him a little credit for that. Good job on you.
Apologies.
Second of all, the play by Lindor was so impressive. I yelled at my kid to come downstairs to go check it out because, like I said on Friday night, my son, no matter what, even though he's a Yankee fan, my youngest, he still likes to watch baseball, and he was enjoying the fact that on Friday that they got the chance to walk it off, which they did. This one, though, I was like, dude, you have to see this play by Francisco Lindor because it's so impressive. The ground he covers. You want to talk about a guy who's hasn't won a gold glove yet. And I think that a part of it is because he covers so much ground. If he doesn't make a play, it's because he puts himself in that opportunity, whereas others wouldn't even come close to it. You know what I mean? Like,
no doubt. Yeah, he has amazing range. That's what used to happen in Ordóñez too, where sometimes you get charged for more errors because you're getting the balls that half the shortstops ain't getting to.
Exactly. So you have that sick play by Lindor. The fact that you kind of just looked over the moonshot, the blast by Pete Alonso is freaking outrageous. He murdered that baseball. Like, Pete Alonso is so stupidly locked in. I don't know how it's going to look like in the next 2 months if he stays this way. His numbers are going to be astronomical.
Well, I don't know if he's going to keep it up. I mean, it'd be great if he did, but I clearly he's a different guy than he was last year. Because, you know, Pete's final numbers were not great, but they were also not awful. A part of why he was criticized from us, too, along with other Met fans, was that he didn't seem to be clutch. He's been clutch this year. I mean, he's been their most clutch player with runners in scoring position, even on games. You know, you look at even Sunday's game where he had that quiet 1-for-5, struck out in a big spot. He also had a big RBI single in the fifth inning. And that home run, you know, we play the Pete Alonso home run test. 2-0 game becomes a 3-0 game. And before Edwin Diaz threw a pitch, I'm sure you would have said, and other Met fans would have said, hey, you know, Edwin hasn't blown it yet, but I'd feel a hell of a lot better with a 3-run lead than a 2-run lead, so that if Edwin Diaz does his typical walk the leadoff hitter, it won't bring the tying run to the plate. So you're right. He murdered that baseball. He has hit 6 home runs this season. He's got 24 RBIs. He's gotten clutch hits. And I would include that one as a clutch hit, turning a 2-0 game into a 3-0 game. And speaking of Edwin Diaz, I was charting how many times he's put the leadoff man on, because it does feel like it's every single outing. So on Saturday, he comes in, does an outstanding job, and strikes out two, pitches a 1-2-3 inning with a three-run lead. That was the first time since April 5th, six appearances ago, that he got the leadoff man out, which is kind of crazy. On April 17th, which was the opener of this series, he walks Nolan Arenado, strikes out the next two guys, gets a ground out to end the game. So walks the first hitter, but gets the job done. April 16th against Minnesota. That was the game that they came back on. Edwin came into a tie game at this point. Walks the leadoff hitter, Harrison Bader. Gets him out on a caught stealing. Gets out of the inning. His performance before that, which was 5 days earlier against the A's, that's when he gave up the two runs. Like, it was a very shaky performance. Walked the leadoff hitter. Ends up getting the job done. But three straight games where he walked the leadoff hitter. We go back to April 9th. Game against the Marlins. That was the implosion game. The one game at Citi Field the Mets have lost this season. Walked Xavier Edwards. Eventually gave up a two-run homer to Matt Mervis. So until, and by the way, before that, April 6th against Toronto, the finale of the sweep against the Blue Jays, he hit Allen Rodin, the leadoff hitter. So he had been on a streak of five consecutive performances, four walks and a hit batsman, in which he put the leadoff man on. He got the leadoff man on the day before the game I just mentioned, April 5th against Toronto, struck out the leadoff hitter, but then put the next two guys on base before he got out of it. And then he had a 1-2-3 inning in the Mets' first win of the year back on March 28th. So this had been an issue all year. It's not something we imagine, but luckily in the Saturday game against the St. Louis Cardinals, it was a non-issue. And Pete, you said something last week on the Reek. I'm just curious if you wanted to edit it. You said that you trust Devin Williams more than Edwin Diaz. How are we on that, Pete?
I know things looked bad Saturday for Devin and the Yankees, but that was on the defense for the Yankees to screw that one over. I still think that Devin Williams at the end of the year will look way better than Edwin Diaz. But yeah, it gave me a little bit more hope that Edwin Diaz can give us some like breather room here. Like, I don't need every game to feel like Armando Benitez. I'm sorry. I don't need that.
Just get the job done. And I'll ask you this question. I'll ask it every time. Even after an Edwin Diaz blown save, I'll probably ask it. How many closers in baseball are truly better? And it is a very short list if you want to come up with a few. Josh Hader is off to a very good start. He didn't have the greatest year last year, but you want to say Josh Hader? Okay. You want to say Emmanuel Clase, who got off to a very bad start this year? You could try. There's not a lot of closers in baseball that are better.
He blew another one today. I mean,
that's right. You know what? I missed that. So he blew another one. So yeah, it ain't Emmanuel Clase.
Yeah. What? If anything, it's Mason Miller. That's like the one guy that I could think of who's like lights out.
It's a short list, is my point. You know, you want to put a couple of guys ahead of him. I'm not going to sit here and argue it. Point is, he's top three, top four closer in Major League Baseball. That's the reality. This was a celebration this weekend. Four straight wins against the St. Louis Cardinals, and you can celebrate your highlights with Mio Sparkling Sake, a true crowd pleaser. Light, bubbly, and easy to enjoy. Whether you're at Citi Field, we got three more games this week, or your favorite spot, ask for Mio Sparkling Sake by name, a new tradition served chilled, imported from Japan, the official sake of Rico Bronya. Enjoy responsibly. Speaking of Mark Vientos, the update we got from Mark after the game on Saturday was he didn't think it was a big deal. He didn't think he drank enough water. It's a groin issue. Carlos Mendoza on Sunday before the game really didn't say much other than he's doing better. He's not in the lineup. He may be available off the bench. So we'll get a better idea on Monday against Aaron Nola if Mark Vientos returns to the starting lineup. It certainly doesn't feel like this is an IL possibility unless they're just completely BSing us. So certainly worth keeping an eye on. Now, they may be getting reinforcements. Jeff McNeil had a 4-for-4 day in Binghamton, 6-for-9 overall in Binghamton. He was 3-for-11 in St. Lucie. So he's gotten 20 to 25 plate appearances. It feels like that's enough because, remember, he did have a spring training. You know, it's not like he missed that much time of spring training. So it's a little bit different than someone who missed all of it. And almost you need to kind of start over which is the case with Alvarez, because Francisco Alvarez got hurt a few weeks earlier than Jeff McNeil. So it certainly feels like McNeil could be on his way back. To me, Ozokar is the one to go down, not Brett Beatty. And that's not to defend Brett Beatty. It's more, I don't think they need Jose Ozokar on this roster. And I guess the difference in view I have so far with Mendy is I'm willing to throw Luis Angel Acuña out there in center field. Now, if you have no confidence in him in center field and you're not in love with Brandon Nimmo playing center field, then maybe that's where they would value Ozokar a little bit more. We have not seen Starling Marte in the outfield yet this year. We've seen Jesse Winker sparingly in the outfield. We've seen Brandon Nimmo almost exclusively play left field. So we haven't seen a lot of shifting towards center. But Luis Angel Acuña needs to stay in this lineup. He's earned that. Remember, he didn't even have the starting second base job coming out of spring training, but between Beatty's struggles, between Mendy's creativity and getting him out there, Acuña's shown off all the skills. He should be out there. And center field feels like the best place for him. The Francisco Alvarez update is that he has now gotten 22 at-bats in Binghamton, 6 for 22. He's had 12 plate appearances in St. Lucie. Probably going to take it slow with him. Probably going to be another couple of days, maybe a week, before we see Francisco Alvarez back. But the Mets are on the mend. And now we begin three games with the Philadelphia Phillies. And this is the last time we're going to see them until late June. I was thinking about this in relation to playing the Phillies and the fact that the Mets haven't played the Braves or the Nationals. They have played Miami 6 times. I really don't like the fact that we only play division rivals 13 times. I'm not sure if people agree with me on this. We used to do it 19 times. It got cut down to 13 times, and now you play all these teams in the other league. The games against the teams in the other league feel very whatever. It's not even special anymore. It used to be like, oh, wow, Mets never play the Minnesota Twins. That's cool. Now you play them every year. But I think the reason it jumps out at me is Mets-Phillies is a fun rivalry. We played them in the NLDS last year. The Mets play three games against them coming up this week. Then they don't play till late June. Then they don't play till late August. And then they wrap it up with four games in early September. So they don't play for a while, and they also don't play very often. It's going to be Aaron Nola on Monday, Christopher Sanchez on Tuesday, and then Zach Wheeler on Wednesday, a Wednesday afternoon game that they'll be playing. They got McGill, Canning, and Peterson. So let's be honest. I know Nola's not off to a good start. This is what's intimidating about the Phillies, despite their struggles. Really not struggling. Only two games behind us, but I guess they feel like they are based on the way that Philly fans talk about them. They got the starting pitching edge in every game, at least on paper. Even if the Mets team ERA continues to be outstanding, it's going to take a while before we look at a Griffin Canning, Christopher Sanchez matchup or a Tyler McGill, Aaron Nola pitching matchup and say huge edge. Where the Mets have an edge as of right now, the Philly bullpen has been horrific. Jordan Romano's been bad. Kirkering's been bad. Their entire bullpen has sucked. I think they got like a 5.5 ERA. So we'll see if that continues and if the Mets could take advantage of it. They have won 4 in a row. They've only lost one game at Citi Field this season, and that was the Wednesday afternoon game against the Miami Marlins. So the importance of this series, Juan Soto downplayed it. He was asked, hey, you know, two games behind in the standings, division rival, and Soto said it's way too early in the season to think about that because it's only 13 games, which is a very small number, and tiebreakers do matter, as we learned last year. I got mocked a lot for talking about tiebreakers. Well, did it not matter? Well, then I would tell you these games matter because I would like to win the National League East. I want to. And winning head-to-head games against the Philadelphia Phillies are important. Now let's get to the Rico star of the series. I got six candidates, but there's one guy who, to me, clearly is your Rico star of the series. Now, just to give you a quick recap, Edwin Diaz in the Houston series, Pete Alonso in the Miami series in Miami, Max Kranich in the series against the Jays, Pete Alonso in the second Miami series, Kodai Senga in the A's series, Pete Alonso for a third time in the Minnesota series. Who now? Now, before I give you my candidates, is there someone that jumps out at you, Pete, as the Rico star of this four-game sweep of the St. Louis Cardinals?
Well, there's three people that stick out to me. I mean, we could keep on going back to Pete Alonso every series. I mean, because he's been that good. He's been that significant. I mean, again, what was it? Did he have four extra base hits this series?
So he went four for 15 with a home run and a triple and three RBIs. So overall, decent numbers for Pete Alonso.
Sure. But it to me, it's these three. Juan Soto, because he finally did his thing. The fans took on, it was like he had his moment for the first time as a Met. So I want to kind of recognize that because I'm expecting this to happen more often, but I do want to recognize the first time it's happened. So I feel like this week, he had his moments with the fans and with this team. So we have to give him a little credit there. I think Francisco Lindor, clearly the walk-off, setting the tone with a leadoff home run. I mean, he's been all over this, sprinkled all over the series as well. So offensively, Francisco Lindor definitely has a nod. Go to, and I know it's tough, we've discussed, you can't really talk about starting pitching because they only affect one game, but I have to go back and look at this. Kodai Senga has pitched 19 straight scoreless innings.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, he just continues this, and it's almost like the next man up. If the pitching staff is what it's been in previous years, where they're like, I need to outdo the guy before me, well, then Kodai Senga continues to set that tone for all starting pitchers. So I look at his numbers and I go, this guy has really impressed. I know I wish he could go a little deeper, but he could be that guy.
The 19 scoreless innings does kind of sneak up on you. But you're right. I mean, you got the 7 scoreless from 2 starts ago or 1 start ago, the 5 2/3 scoreless from this recent start, and the start before that was 5 scoreless. So, yeah, he's been outstanding. I think that a starting pitcher, and we had Kodai Senga win the Rico Star of the Series for the A Series, in which they won 2 out of 3. So it's not impossible. It can happen. I wrote down 6 candidates. Let me start with the bullpen guys. Reed Garrett. Reed Garrett comes in the other day, gets a huge out to clean up Kodai Senga's mess, then pitches a 1-2-3 inning. He also pitched in game 1 of this series and pitched a scoreless inning and got a hold. So 2 holds, 2 1/3 scoreless innings. Edwin Diaz, same thing. He saved game 1 of this series. He saves game 3 of this series. 2 scoreless innings for Edwin Diaz. But let's get to the bats, because I think there will be a winner from the bats. Honorable mention of Mark Vientos. Mark Vientos hit the home run in game 1, gave him an early lead. Had 2 more hits in game 2, hit another home run, and was 0-for-2 before he mysteriously left game 3. Unfortunately for Vientos, he never got to complete this series. If he does, maybe his numbers look different. Maybe instead of hitting 2 home runs, he gets 5 home runs or 4 home runs. Who the hell knows? Overall, 3-for-10, 2 home runs, 2 RBIs. I think it was also just the importance of seeing Vientos get going. You mentioned Pete Alonso. He had a lot of big hits in this series. He took an offer in game 1, but he had the triple in game 2, which was very memorable. He hit the big insurance home run, plus drove in 2 in game 3. And even in game 4, he had the RBI single. Overall, 4-for-15, a home run, 3 RBIs. Unfortunately, Pete, you've already won it 3 times. This will not be a 4th, but it was a good series for you. Then you got Juan Soto. You mentioned it. Since the booing after his 0-for-5 start to this series, he went out and got on base 7 of 10 times, but overall 5-for-13, drove in 5 runs in this series, an RBI in game 2. He drove in a run in game 3. He had 3 RBIs in game 4. But to me, the winner, and I don't think it's particularly close, is Francisco Lindor. Because not only does Lindor go 7-for-18 in this series with 2 home runs, he hits a game-winning walk-off home run in game 2. His defense, as you talked about earlier with you and your son watching it, the play he made in the 8th inning, in the A.J. Minter inning, saved game 3. So even though he took an 0-for-4, his defense made a huge difference. And then game 4 of this series, he sets the tone on Easter with the leadoff home run. He ends up getting 3 hits. This was the Lindor series from beginning to end. From game 1 when he got on base 3 times, the game we were at, and we're like, whoa, okay, April Lindor may be dead. We may start seeing hot Lindor. So I think it's clearly Francisco Lindor for the first time this year. But honorable mention of all those other guys. Look, the Mets swept the 4-game series. You know, when you sweep a 4-game series, it ain't just going to be one guy. I'm telling you, they're going to be some Rico Star of the Series you know, when they're not playing well, where it's going to be like, geez, everybody sucked. We got to find somebody. But when you sweep a four-game series, it's the exact opposite. So for the first time this season, Francisco Lindor, congratulations. You are the Rico star of the series.
Cheers. Cheers. Cheers, Francisco. Well deserved. And by the way, his hair is looking extra foofy these days, which is incredible.
Yes, he's got the new look. Reminds me of Piazza back in the day. Mike used to change the color sometimes. He would change his look sometimes. The captain's looking good. As long as he's hitting, I don't give a crap, man. I don't care. All right, let's get set for three games against the Phillies. This should be fun. This should be a challenge. Two-game lead. The dream of just sweeping them and opening up a comfortable lead in the NL East. I don't know if they'll be able to do that. But 15-7, a 110-win pace, 8-1 at home, cherish it. Because baseball is a ruthless game. And at the turn of a dime, things will get bad. I'm not saying that to be pessimistic. I'm saying that to remind you that that's what baseball is. When you're too high and you're too confident and, this is great, we're going to roll to 110 wins, you will be humbled. Let's just hope the humbling doesn't come this week against our blood rivals, the Philadelphia Phillies. If you have any thoughts, you can always email us, thericob@gmail.com, thericob@gmail.com. I give you an example of a good email. This is coming from Anthony. Anthony writes, I love the pod, guys, but I was listening to episode 466. Please, 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 since you have such a large following, correct the misnomer that the tie goes to the runner. There is no such rule. The runner is either out or safe. If he's called safe, he's safe. And if he's called out, he's out. While clearly the runner and the ball could arrive at the exact same time, there's no such thing as tie goes to the runner. Anthony is so right. And yet, I know this. Most of us know this. There is no rule that says tie goes to the runner, yet we repeat it over and over and over again. Keith Hernandez is a great example of it. He says it all the time. And Keith knows there's no tie that goes to the runner. So it's a great point, Anthony. I think most of us fall victim to it. We have to stop because you are right. There is no rule that says tie goes to the runner. One last email. Tom writes, MV Pete. Evan, Pete, my first two emails I sent you were negative, and my last email, and this one, is positive. Where would we be if we never had Amazing Day and Steve Cohen didn't hear the boos from the fans and didn't go out to Florida to talk to Pete Alonso about coming back? I mean, our offense would not nearly be the same, and we might not be in first place after Pete's start to the season. My question is, do you think Uncle Stevie would open the checkbook for MV Pete in the offseason? Well, I don't want to think about the offseason in April. I think that the Met attitude towards Pete Alonso will be the same as it was this year. Show me the market, and we will decide if that fits what we want to do. The Met attitude with Alonso was, go prove you have a bigger offer out there and bring it back to us. He was never able to do that. Now, if Pete does have an MV Pete kind of season, and he's got a five-year, $180 million offer out there, or something crazy or whatever it is, the question will be, if it's out there, does Steve say, all right, I'm going to match that? We got a long way to go. So don't overthink it. Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the ride. Thank you very much for downloading Rico Brogna. Remember, rate, subscribe, and hang out with us. We guarantee you Rico after every series. And we mix in some instant reactions after certain games. We appreciate you listening. Thank you very much. Happy Easter. Thanks for listening to Rico Brogna.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Brogna podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.